Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. Every weekend, we visit with Valley veterans of World War II. Our goal is to honor their service and sacrifice for the sake of our freedom, to preserve their stories for posterity, and hopefully along the way to inspire those of you who might be closer to my age to live up to that legacy that has been left for us by the members of the Greatest Generation. I have one of those members of the Greatest Generation with me today. And before we get to Navy veteran Lou Munchie, I just want to remind you about a couple of events that are coming up. We'll go in chronological order. And on May 17th at 5 o'clock in Visalia at the Gateway Auditorium, there is a big concert with the Sounds of Freedom Military Band. Now, you hear this band's music on my program every week whenever we play the service songs, and we'll probably do that later today. That's the Sounds of Freedom Band, a local volunteer group performing in Visalia on May 17th at 5 o'clock at the Gateway Auditorium. It is a free concert. They will be accepting donations for the Wounded Warrior Project, which you can find more about at woundedwarriorproject.org. But mark that on your calendar, May 17th, Gateway Auditorium in Visalia at 5 o'clock. Then, on the following Sunday, May 24th in downtown Fresno at the Veterans Memorial Auditorium, it's the third annual Heroes of the Valley event honoring the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. You've heard me talk about this museum time and time again. And go to heroesofthevalley.com to find out more about that great event. We'll be talking more about that next week. But let me not take up any more of your time before getting to my guest today. As I said, a Navy veteran of World War II who's still carrying around a couple souvenirs from his service during that period in our country's history. Lou Munchie is here today. And Lou, do I have this correct? You're a Bakersfield driller?
That's right.
Class of 42.
That's right.
And I understand you were quite the terror on the basketball court back then.
Yes. Yeah, I played, we come up here and played Edison for the Valley Championship. And we lost.
Aha. Uh-huh. But you were there nonetheless. And shortly after graduating from Bakersfield High School in 1942, Uncle Sam got a hold of you. Now, you enlisted in the Navy so you could go in the air? You wanted to fly in the Navy as opposed to the Air Corps?
Yes, I wanted to be a Navy pilot.
Uh-huh. Now, there are a lot of guys that go in thinking they're going to be a pilot, whether it's in the Air Corps or in the Navy. How long was it before you figured out they're not going to let me be a pilot?
Well, it was about 2 months after I got out of boot camp in Farragut, Idaho.
Farragut, Idaho. And I always crack up when I've talked to so many veterans who were sent to Farragut, Idaho for naval training. And I didn't think that snowy weather would prepare you for working at sea.
Well, no, that was just boot camp.
Uh-huh.
You know, and of course, they give you everything that if you go aboard ship, that you learn all about it. And I spent a winter up there, so it's pretty cold.
And as so many veterans, you got bounced around to a lot of places around the country and got a taste of different parts. So you're from Bakersfield, but they had you in Burbank. They had you up in Crow's Landing on the west side of the valley, Moffett Field in the Bay Area, and Alameda Naval Air Station. And eventually, you achieved the rating of Aviation Machinist Mate, Second Class. And then it was at that point, I understand, that they sent you overseas, right? Do I have that right so far?
Yeah, I did all that training. We did extensive training.
And this, I don't mean to gloss over it. This is some hard work, right?
Yeah, and after the training and everything, we left, most of the squadron left from Crow's Landing.
Mm-hmm.
But then we went down to San Diego, two crews went down there.
Uh-huh. And so many veterans that I talk to, you hear it was the first mission that was the one that knocked their socks off. Sometimes it's the second or the third, but so often early on in their time in the war, particularly guys that ended up flying as you did, it didn't take long before they had that welcome to the war moment, even if no one was shooting at them. And that certainly was the case for you. Tell us about your first flight assignment off the continent and what they told you to do and what happened. Now, you were part of a crew that's supposed to deliver a B-24 Liberator to Hawaii, right?
That's right. And we took off from Lindbergh Field in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
at night. We traveled till the next morning, and we ran into a storm, and we was bucking a headwind. And we got to within 20 miles of Kaneohe, which is on Oahu, and no more fuel. So we knew it was going to run short of fuel because of the headwind. So,
but there's not a lot you can do, right? You can't turn around and make it back.
It's not like flying in a jet. Jet can go to another, you know, someplace else. Mm-hmm. And it was raining and storming so bad you couldn't even see. And our radar went out, so we couldn't pick up land.
And this is the very first time that you've been sent on a mission.
This is the first time that leaving the States. First time.
So what's going through your mind when you see this weather and you realize your B-24 is running out of gas and there's no land in sight?
It didn't bother me too much because, hey, at that time I was 20 years old. And, you know, at 20 years old, nothing's going to hurt you. You know, you got that in your mind. You're not going to get killed. You're not going to get hurt. It's just automatic with you. And it just so happened that the radio man got on the key, and it was Mayday, Mayday, to let them know that we was eventually going to ditch. But before they had a chance to ditch, all four engines quit. We hit the ocean.
Well, and just to keep our listeners informed, these B-24s were going to be assigned for photo reconnaissance in the South Pacific. But the B-24, I've heard described before, affectionately known as a flying anvil. And when you lost all four engines, I guess it really did become an anvil and went pretty much straight into the water.
That's right. And the that's a Liberator now we're talking about.
Right.
Not the B-24 privateer.
Right.
Navy insignia, or it's the Liberator is known as a PB-4Y-1.
That's right.
Now, the privateer is known as a PB-4Y-2.
And you'd be in those later on. But for now, all you're thinking about is surviving this somehow as this flying anvil goes smack dab into the Pacific Ocean with no land in sight. So you've radioed a Mayday, your engines stop, you go right into the water, and I imagine that plane didn't stay intact. It had to have broken up.
It broke up into three pieces. No section broke off. The tail section broke off, and the wing section was still afloat a little bit,
and
partly underwater. The reason for that is because your fuel tanks are in the wing section, and they were empty, so
there was some buoyancy.
Kind of held it up a little bit.
And where were you through all of this?
I was in the after station with the ordnancemen, and we was looking out the side hatches to see if we could see land, and the rain was coming down so hard you couldn't see nothing, and consequently, when we hit, I don't know how I got out of it. To this day, I do not know how I got out of that aircraft.
What did it feel like on impact?
Well, actually, you don't have time to think. And, you know, everything hit me in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And I got cut up and broken ribs. But I didn't even notice my broken ribs. I got cut on my forehead on both sides, and one cut was worse than the other, and the blood closed that one eye, so where I couldn't see out of it. But through my training and everything, I had sense enough when I come up to go up on the wing section, and then on the fuselage in the middle of the wings, there's two rings, which when you pull them, they inflate the rafts. So I pulled one, got one raft out, and then I took and set it down at the trailing edge of the wind, and I spotted my radio man. How he got clear back there, I don't know. I helped him in the one raft, and then went back and popped the other one, got it down there, and tied them together, and got the co-pilot in that one. And then I went back, yelling for two of the guys, Pete Varner and Jim Fowler. And I never did. I couldn't. No response or anything. Of course, that part of the plane was underwater anyway. I would have never seen them. So it's you know, when you're here in a few minutes, and then you're gone. You know, it kind of gets you. You know, and it bothered me. It bothered me, and it still did after I got out of the service.
I can imagine it's something that sticks with you for a long time. And I'm curious how long it took you before the thought entered your mind that easily could have been me. Why did I survive this and those guys didn't?
That come to me after I was in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That come to me after I was in the hospital.
But long before you got in the hospital, just because you're awake and alive and somehow find yourself in the water, like you say, you don't know how, you get the raft inflated, you help some of your friends out, but you're still floating in the ocean. And you're not safe yet. You're not on land. You don't know where you are. How long did that persist before somebody did spot you and rescued you?
Well, you know, time, it's just like the wing section. When it went down, it went down within a matter of a few minutes, not very long. It went on down. That's the reason why I got off from it, because I thought maybe it might suck me down.
Mm-hmm.
But after we got into the rafts, I got in with a co-pilot, not the co-pilot, but with a radioman, and the co-pilot, I guess he must have been a little bit in shock, because he started feeding the fish, upchucking.
Mm-hmm.
And the radioman and I was in one raft, and I told him, just break out the sail and catch the rain, because I knew we could live without food for a long time, but water you got to have.
So you're already thinking this may be a while before anybody finds us.
Yeah, well, I didn't know where we was at. Mm-hmm. I, of course, it just so happens we was about 20 miles offshore, and one of the pilots of the other crew, he got word that we went down, and he went and got a plane, and by that time the weather cleared up, you know, and he come out looking for us, and then. Coronado, you know what? Coronado flying boat, four-engine flying boat.
Yep, yep.
They spotted us.
Mm-hmm.
And they kicked a life raft out for these other three, the pilot, navigator, and ordnance man that was floating around with just their Mae West. So they kicked a raft out for them, and they never did get to it. I mean, it hit that water, and it bounced. I don't know how far.
Now, you mentioned the Mae West, and for those of you who aren't familiar, there's a famous photo from World War II of the actual Mae West demonstrating how to put on one of those life vests that the servicemen were issued. So you came to just refer to those as Mae West. And during this whole ordeal, you eventually realized that you had never inflated your Mae West, right? How long were you swimming around before you figured that out?
Well, I was swimming around, and I didn't inflate it. When I got into the life raft, I'm sitting there next to the radioman, and I think, you know, I seen his vest all puffed up, you know. So I looked at mine, I pulled the two strings, and it inflated.
Well, you had survived just fine without it, apparently. I think somebody was looking out for you. So they eventually track you down. A crash boat comes up, picks you guys up. They take you to the hospital. They give you some x-rays. They tell you you've got two broken ribs. And then I understand next there was something emotional for you and your crew that you felt the need that you needed to do before you left that part of the world. What was that you did?
Well, we had a memorial for the two that went down on the ship, on the plane. And one of the ground crew officers took myself and the ordnance man into Honolulu, and we bought a bunch of flowers and brought them back to the church. We had the memorial services, and after that, we loaded all the flowers on one of the privateers, and the ordnance man and myself got on the plane, and we flew over where we went down, and we threw out the flowers where we went down, and with the kid. I guess they're still there. I mean, it's a sad. It's really, you know, it kind of sticks with you. You know, something like that just I don't know.
I can tell. It's still emotional for you here today, and I think every single one of our listeners can understand that. I'll tell you what, Lou, we're going to take a break right here. When we come back, we'll talk about what you did after that fateful first mission that ended up in the Pacific Ocean. We're so thankful that you survived and that you're sharing this story with us here today. And you had some more close calls, and you have the souvenirs to prove it. So we're going to talk about that when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ. Anchors away today in honor of Navy veteran Lou Munchie, my guest on the program this afternoon, and the music performed there by the Sounds of Freedom Band. You can catch him in a free concert May 17th, 5 o'clock at the Gateway Auditorium in Visalia. When we talked to Lou before the break, he told us about that first mission that he flew in a B-24 Liberator. That was the PB-4Y-1. And how his plane went into the water, ran out of gas outside of Hawaii, went into the Pacific Ocean, broke into three pieces. Somehow he survived along with some of his crewmates. You heard about that. He went in the hospital briefly, but it wasn't long before you're out flying over the open seas again. And you hear so much about flying during the war and bombers specifically, and people assume that a lot of this was done at high altitude. And that was the case for some planes later in the war in the U.S. Army Air Corps. But for what you guys were doing, and maybe the insignia of your unit, the VPB-123, is a good indication. That insignia shows the Woody Woodpecker character riding bareback on a bomb with a gun in his hand. And I guess that's kind of what you guys felt like, because you're flying these altered B-24s at pretty low altitude, right? And trying to disrupt Japanese shipping. Do I have that right?
That's right. We come in real low. In fact, I didn't see it, but I've heard where some of the bombers come back, not my squadron. One of them come back with part of the ship in his bomb bay where it blew. That's low. That is low.
Flying low enough that the explosion sent parts of the ship back up into the plane that bombed it.
That's right.
Wow.
And not only that, when I was in the hospital in the my crew went out and made a raid on Shanghai, China, and they almost hit a smokestack. That's how close they were there.
Now, that sounds like a pretty dangerous job, because not only is there less margin for error when you're flying that low, you're a lot more susceptible to ground fire, right?
Yeah, well, that thing there was on a night mission, and the gunners couldn't fire. All they did was throw out foil to throw the radar off. The Japanese radar off.
And you're usually flying in just two plane groups? It's just you and one other plane?
Yes.
So I imagine if something happens to you, you're kind of out of luck. Not a whole lot of chance for survival, or if you do survive, you're going to be in hostile territory. There aren't a bunch of other people to come around and pick you up.
That's right.
So what was your mindset going into a mission like that? I know you're all in it together, but it can't be very encouraging looking at those odds.
Well, no, like, hey, you're young, and you're invincible?
Uh-huh.
You know you're not going to die. You're not going to die.
Even when you've seen your friends and crew members not come back, you still keep that mentality.
Out of my crew, or out of my squadron, there was four that didn't come back.
Mm-hmm.
Just four. Now, this is ironic, because before we left to go overseas, Pete was playing a Ouija on a Ouija board, and he asked it. He says, how many of us is not going to come back? And it went to four, and he was one of them that didn't come back.
Oh, man. Well, I'm so glad that you came back and that you're here to share some of these stories with us, and I know you had a lot of memorable missions in the skies. I understand you even flew through a typhoon. Now, I've heard from sailors who have survived some typhoons. We've had some of them on this program, and it's some of the most terrific stuff that I've ever heard. What was it like to actually fly through one of those systems in the air?
Well, going in is rough, and our nose of our plane was faced down, but we're still gaining altitude. Then when we got into the center of the storm, it was calm, just as calm as can be. Then going on the other side, it got rough again. Then we come out of it, and then we went on into looking for Jap shipping after that.
Mm-hmm. So that was a bit of an adventure.
It was.
That's one where you take stock after you come through something like that.
That's right.
Now, there's a question I've asked a few of my guests on this program over the years, and maybe I get too much of a chuckle out of asking it because it's no laughing matter. But when you try to go board an airplane at the airport today and you have to walk through that metal detector, do you ever set it off even if you're not wearing anything metal?
Oh, yeah.
Every time?
Well, I've got other metal in me besides the shrapnel.
Oh, okay.
I got, you know, and with it all, I got metal in my wrist, metal in my, you know, my knees.
By choice.
Yeah. But
Not by enemy.
But I always say it always goes off. And they take those paddles and go all over me.
Now, I brought that up because I've been telling our listeners that you still have a couple souvenirs as evidence of your service during the war. And these are not souvenirs you can take out and show anybody because they're actually in the small of your back and they've been there for more than 60 years. And I want you to describe for us, if you can, how you ended up with those souvenirs that I keep talking about. You're on a B-24. Now, this is the privateer, the PB-4Y-2. And what was this particular plane called?
Oh.
On the nose? You had some nose?
Jackass Jenny.
Uh-huh. And I guess you had a pretty memorable experience on one of your final flights in her.
Yeah, we took and was going, and well, we bombed sunk three ships. Now, I'm talking about both crews, two planes.
The two planes together.
We sank three ships and a possible fourth. And we started to head for home. Well, the lead plane, he went through, he saw this radar radio station sitting in a kind of like a hillside, of the, you know, how those mountains are over there. And he went through first, and he says, he radioed back, and he says to my pilot, he says, "Hey, Dick," he says, "come on through. They're just throwing up small arms." So my pilot figured, well, fine. We'll go in and strafe, you know. So we went through, and when we got through there, they was sitting waiting for us with the big ones. They hit us with ACAC fire, and it hit right below my turret. I'm in the top aft turret. Right below my turret, and took part of the trailing edge of the wing.
So you're serving as a gunner on this flight, on this B-24.
Yeah,
you're in a gun turret.
And but as we started to go through, I could see that I wasn't going to get a shot facing to the left. So I said, "Well, I'll turn my turret around, and maybe I'll get a shot going out." Well, it's a good thing I did. Because when that thing hit, it just sprayed my seat that I was in. It was just a mass of shell fragments in it.
So if you hadn't have turned around, then this ground fire would have caught you right in your front, right in your belly.
I'd have got gut shot, and that'd have been it, probably.
But instead, it went through the seat that you were sitting in and into your back.
Yeah, back of the seat. One went through the back of the seat and missed my spine about a fraction of an inch. Dr. Downey here in town, he x-rayed it one time, and he said you was really lucky because if it had been over to the left a little bit more, it would have got my spine.
So if you hadn't turned around, you would have been dead.
That's
and if it,
it
hit a half an inch over, you would have been paralyzed.
That's right.
I think you got the best of those three options.
Oh, you better believe it.
Somebody was looking out for you. But that said, I can't imagine it felt very good. What did you feel like you were on fire? What did that feel like?
When that shell fragment went in, it was just like a steel poker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it real hot going in. That's just what it felt like.
And you reached back there, felt how big it was?
I put three fingers in that hole.
That couldn't have been very encouraging.
Well, it wasn't because I thought, that, you know, we didn't carry any plasma on the plane or anything, you know, in case, and I got to think, well, man, I might bleed to death.
But so, that's when it's good to have friends of yours on board the plane.
Well, I get my one of my gunners, he was in the teardrop on the side of the teardrop, one of the teardrop turrets, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He got some sulfa out. We had a first aid kit, and he put sulfa and everything on it and put a bandage across it, and then we headed for home.
No big deal.
Well, it didn't bother me. That didn't bother as much as that crash in the ocean.
Well, I can understand that.
You know, and coming home with this plane, the wing where the side where it hit is kind of going like this, you know?
Well, yeah, there was some human damage on the plane, but I imagine that plane was shot up pretty good.
Yeah, it was when we got back to Okinawa, we come into Okinawa and we're supposed to make a diamond. You know, instead of what you call a come straight in on the land, we had to make a diamond to let them know we was friendly. We had IFF, which is identification friend or foe.
Right.
We had it on too, but that don't mean too much either. And so we come straight in. And I told my second mech, I said, tell the pilot you're going to purge the tanks, the fuel tanks, because I didn't tell them what was going to happen. I might blow up when we hit.
Yeah, you don't want to land and then have an explosion on the runway. Sure.
So anyway, after they took me all off and everything, I found out that they scrapped the plane. We didn't fly again.
So you were on one plane that disintegrated in the Pacific Ocean, another one that got shot up, limped in, and never flew again. You're pretty fortunate to come out of both of those situations with all your limbs.
The Lord has been good to me, I'll say that.
But when you did touch down, you'd been patched up on the plane. But I imagine you had to have a little more medical attention than that. Did they send you to the hospital?
Well, now there's the front lines now. They're still fighting on the island. They're still fighting. And the front lines...
This is on Okinawa, you said?
Yeah. Uh-huh. The front lines was only about, I would say, a little over a mile away from where we had our tents. Well...
So you can hear the 105 guns and all of those going off.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. And then what they did was they took the meat wagon, took me over to first aid station. He gave me a shot, and he gave the other, my ordnance man, he got a little piece in the back of his... by his ear, and give him a shot. And then they took me down to it was like a big circus tent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they were bringing all the front line. The guys were wounded from the front line. They put me on a slab there, and the doctor come by, and he looked at me, looked at my back, and he said, we're too busy now. We'll have to bring this man back later on.
This is a triage situation. This is a triage situation, and there are a lot more urgent cases than you.
And believe me, I'm glad they did, because those poor guys, I got a lot of respect for the troops, the ground troops, believe me. So they took me back down to a tent and put me in there. I was there for a day and a half. So I thought, well, that's the heck with it. So I packed my deal, and I couldn't hardly walk. You know, I was all humped over. And I walked up to the airstrip. And here come a pilot. I don't know. He just happened to be driving along in a Jeep, him. And he says, what are you doing here? I says, they're not doing anything for me. I says, I'm coming back to the outfit. He said, oh, no. He says, So they put me back in the Jeep and took me back down to the tent. The next day, they worked on me.
Uh-huh. So you're that classic patient who didn't want to sit around and wait for them to treat you. You just said, the heck with this, I'm getting out of here.
That's right.
But... thanks to your pilot, he took you back, and then maybe that upped you on the priority list a little bit, I suppose.
I think he went and talked to him. That's what he did, because they didn't take me back down to the circus tent. They took me to a deal where his old Marine doctor was right out in the open, and they put me on a kind of like a little slab, portable X-ray. He X-rayed it, and he took long, looked like, you know, skewers, you know, so long, and he's going in there, and he'd shoot it with a little deadening, and then he'd go in there trying to find it. He cleaned it all out on both wounds. And he said, there's no way I can get it. If backward area, he said they could probably get him out, but I can't. So
you've been carrying those pieces of shrapnel around ever since?
For over 60 years.
Has that ever bothered you at all? Has it ever presented any physical complications?
Well, when I first got out of the service, my back started hurting me, so I went down and I went to a doctor. It was supposed to have been an Army doctor or government doctor, and he checked me over. And I guess a couple months after that, I started getting 10% disability. I never asked for it. I didn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it said permanent. And I never have gone in to see if I get any more because I didn't want it in the first place.
You were pretty thankful that you made it back alive.
That's right.
And as we're talking about that, you're describing the Battle of Okinawa is raging on the island. That's where you were taken back. And those that know the timeline know that this is getting pretty close to the end of the war. Did you fly any more missions before VJ Day came?
Oh, yeah, yeah. When I got out of the hospital, I flew a few missions. Even after the war, we started flying reconnaissance, you know, around to check on things. This is after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And my pilot went home, but the co-pilot took over in his place. And we flew out over Formosa, which is Taiwan now.
Right.
And airfields all over that island. And he's buzzing every one of those airfields. And I'm watching the fuel flow gauge, you know, on the plane.
Run out of gas once, you don't want to do it again.
I told the radio operator. I said, "You call and tell the pilot, hey, if we don't go home pretty quick, we're going to take another swim." and to this day, my car half tank, I fill it up.
I believe you.
Half tank, I fill it up.
I don't blame you. Once you've done it once, you don't want to do it again. Let me ask you, so you were still back there in the Pacific when VJ Day happened in August of 1945. Do you remember where exactly you were when you heard that news and what it meant to you at the time that this war that had changed your life and changed so many lives was finally over?
Well, you know, it didn't affect me that much, and I can't remember exactly where I was at. But it didn't affect me that much, you know, not like, you know, like the people in the States here, Ray, oh boy, Ray, you know, all this and that. It didn't affect me that you know. And the people say, well, hero. Now, my family think I'm a hero. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Anybody else, I'm no hero. I'm a patriot. I love my country. I really love my country. And I joined the Navy. I went to the show and saw this flag, you know, on the screen with Kate Smith singing God Bless America.
Yep.
Hey, and it got to me. That's why I joined.
Well, thank the Lord for Kate Smith, because we are very fortunate.
There's probably a lot of them that did the same thing. I had my cousin, he joined the Coast Guard. I had my best buddy, he joined the Navy. My brother joined, well, he didn't join. He got drafted. Of course, he's married and had a little boy, and he tried to stay out, but he had to go in. He wound up in Philippines.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to ask you, though, you just told us why you joined and why it was important for you to serve your country and your love for your country and how that motivated you. I want to know, and I always enjoy asking veterans this, especially someone like you who's had some really close calls. I mean, crashing the plane into the ocean and to survive that is impressive. Getting shot in the back and coming home from that, you've had some close calls. Have you ever thought about how many people wouldn't be here if you didn't make it back? Because you didn't get married till 1949. How many kids and grandkids do you have that would have never existed if you hadn't been able to find your way back home?
Well, I don't think about it. I just don't think about those things, you know? I mean, it's like I say, I love my country, and I joined. And, of course, there's a lot of kids my age joined at the same time.
That's right.
You know? Where I'm fortunate is that I didn't go overseas before I did. In other words, I got at the end of the they was at the bottom of the barrel for their fighter pilots. You know, they didn't dare. Few of them come in on us, but very few, because on that privateer, there's 12 machine guns, 50 calibers.
Yeah, you mess with them, you're going to get shot.
Six turrets.
Uh-huh.
You know, so.
Well, I think I can safely speak for your children and grandchildren when I say that I'm glad that you came home, because they wouldn't be here and you wouldn't be sitting here sharing these stories. So I'm very appreciative of that. We're out of time on the program, Lou, but I just want to thank you for serving our country and for sharing your stories with us today.
Thank you.
That's Lou Munchie, our guest today. You've been listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.